Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode. Before we start, I need to tell you about SeamsEasy.com. SeamsEasy is the best way to fix ugly record jacket seam splits easy and forever. SeamsEasy repairs record jackets from the inside, so the record jacket remains useful and handsome just like you. Check them out at SeamsEasy.com. That's two Z's, SeamsEasy.com. Grab a pack of 10, 25, or if you're a record shop or dealer, get the 100 pack because you'll need them and you'll love them. That seems easy record jacket repair strips. Seems easy? Well, that's because it is. And while we're at it, don't forget about Groove Washer. The best record cleaner on earth is made smack dab in the middle of the USA. Clean your records, make them look and sound their very best, and preserve them for a lifetime. Groove Washer is the way to go. Ask for it by name at your local record shop, and don't accept anything less. Or you could head over to groovewasher.com, and guess what? Here's an online discount code for your troubles. Type in VinylGuide10 at checkout for 10% off whatever you buy at groovewasher.com. That's groovewasher.com, promo code VinylGuide10. Groovewasher.com, proud to be made in the USA. And with that, let's get into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Hey, this is Josh Fries, and you are listening to The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading and listening to The Vinyl Guide. Thanks to everyone who's been sharing these episodes. And a huge, huge thanks to our show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Again, this week you are getting another extended interview. I'm doing that quite frequently. I put extended discussions and interview segments just for our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. If you're not already a show patron, well, you can change that this very moment. Head up to patreon.com/vinylguide, sign up, get early access to episodes, get extended interviews, one-offs, and a whole bunch of extra stuff, including an extended interview of the one we have today. Now today we are talking to Mr. Josh Fries, a man with more recording credits than I can even begin to name here on the show, but there's quite a few fascinating ones which we cover today. For example, Josh played and wrote part of Guns N' Roses' Chinese Democracy, and we talk about that today. Josh even played on the first three albums from A Perfect Circle, and again, we talk about that today. He played on the never-yet-released Nine Inch Nails Tool supergroup project Tapeworm. We talk about that today. Josh even played on Dweezil Zappa's first solo album and has a real fascinating and sweet story about him and Frank Zappa. We hear about that today. Josh plays with Devo, Sting, The Vandals, which again, we cover in today's discussion, as well as go in depth into The Vandals' Live Fast Diarrhea album, now celebrating 25 years with a poopy splatter pressing that will delight your inner child. Head over to NitroRecords.com or ask your local record shop about the grossest vinyl pressing that they stock. There can be only one, and it's clearly The Vandals. Live Fast Diarrhea, available at NitroRecords.com. And again, as I said, there is an extended interview with Josh up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Become a show patron and hear all the extras up there, plus get early access to episodes, you get secret episodes, as well as my eternal appreciation. In the show extras, Josh shares a lot more about drumming for Devo, Nine Inch Nails stories, and more, and it's only available to patrons of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. Please consider signing up, and I do appreciate all the support. And finally, if you enjoy this interview, there's a ton of somewhat related episodes of The Vinyl Guide you'll also likely enjoy, including episodes 133 and 134, featuring Brian Brain Mantia, drummer of Primus and Guns N' Roses. Today, Josh and I talk about how Brain replaced Josh's drum tracks, and you can hear Brain's side of the story on episode 134 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 122 of The Vinyl Guide features Billy Howerdell of A Perfect Circle, and lots of fascinating tales on that one as well. Now, I've also had several Zappa-related episodes, including multiple Zappa siblings on the show. Dweezil on episode 94, Moon Unit on episode 109, Ahmet Zappa and Joe Vaultmeister Travers, episodes 163 and 194, plus heaps, heaps more. Subscribe to the Vinyl Guide podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Sonnet, or wherever you get your wonderful podcasts. Alrighty, that is it for the upfronts. Without further delay, let's get into today's conversation with drum legend Josh Fries.
Mr. Fries.
Hey, hey.
How are you, man?
What's happening?
Hey, it's all good. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. I haven't really checked the news today, but I'm assuming something crazy's happened, and that's just where the bar is at these days. If I'm waking up and the coffee machine works, I'm okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's the little things that all of a sudden, stand out a little bit more and you appreciate and, you know.
So how is work for you these days? I mean, you know, you've had the last couple decades of running around doing sessions right. All over the world and kind of hit the brakes the past few months. What's been going on?
Well, I mean, I have to admit, after the initial shock of, most of my years worth of plans and work kind of vanishing overnight, after I got over that, I kind of went, you know what? You know, once the dust settled a bit, I started looking on the bright side of the fact that I have been running around like a chicken with his head cut off for decades now and working my ass off. And, I hate to say that I've kind of been enjoying the forced time out that I've been having to kind of take. And when I say forced time out, it's more like I'm being forced to do, or I'm getting forced to have the opportunity to do things that I've wanted to do for a long time, but have never been able to justify making the time to do them and put the time aside to do them, whether it be to write more music, whether it be to experiment with video stuff, whether, you know, to do other things other than just showing up and playing drums for whoever's hiring me.
So with your schedules, folks on the have come on the show, and I'm always amazed how they're able to plan so far ahead. They know what they're doing in 2 or 3 years. They know that the summer of 2022, they're going to be on the road with this other band or whatever. At least it's kind of somewhat stenciled in. This has all of a sudden been brought to a halt. But before that, you probably knew what you were doing 2 or 3 years ahead of time, yeah?
Well, I didn't really know what I was doing 2 or 3 years ahead of time, but I definitely knew what I was doing for the next year. And I could kind of guess sort of what I would be doing the following year. And when I say that, it's, my main full-time job for the last 4 or 5 years has been playing with Sting again. So I work with Sting. And when I have time off from that, then I do sessions for other people, or I do one-off gigs with the Vandals or with Devo.
And are the Vandals playing live much these days? Or, well, not these days, but I mean up to 2019.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, when shows started getting cleared and taken off the books back in, I guess it was like early March or middle of March, we had a couple things we were doing in L.A. Like a Orange County show and or an L.A. show. And then we had something out of town a few weeks later, and then going to Europe for like a week. I think I was having to sit that out due to other things I had happening. But yes, a similar thing. I mean, the thing about the Vandals is like none of us really make a living doing it, So everyone kind of has their quote unquote real jobs outside of the band. And it's this point, and for a while, it's been kind of like a labor of love, where sometimes it starts to blur that line where we go, wow, we got paid really well on that gig last night. Shit, maybe this is for real. But the difference is we can't, sometimes we get paid really well on a gig. If we were able to do that 5 nights a week all over the country, then we could make a living doing it, but we don't. It's too, the markets are too kind of spotty and shoddy for us to be consistent about it. And we're all now adults with wives and kids and mortgages and can't just do it for fun. You know what I mean? But really what it boils down to is that's why we're still doing it. At least for me, it's like, you know what I mean? And I think for them too, it's like, you know, yeah, sure. It's nice to get paid to do a gig here or there, but it's like, really, we do it because we like hanging out together and because we don't do tons of it, we still do enjoy it. Maybe if we were touring all the time, we'd hate each other by now. But it's like I said, seldom enough that it's still kind of novel and fun to get together and do gigs. And I still, you know, am fantasizing that we're going to make another really cool record. And I'm, just the other day, I'm like, why are we not making a record right now? Like, why isn't every band making records right now when they've got nothing to do but write and record? Because they can't go play shows. Anyways, I've got a bunch of songs I'm sitting on. I'm going to try and kind of, I think, trick those other guys into just like showing up to my house to like, hey, you should play guitar in these two songs. You know, next thing you know, we can look back and go, shit, we've got half a record done. You know, so we'll see. We'll see. Okay. Right?
We've got the reissue of Live Fast Diarrhea coming out. Mm-hmm. That album is quite a landmark in the Vandals' career. What did that album mean to the band when it came out?
That record, it's funny to me because I look back on it and have for years now, because like you said, it has been 25 years, starting probably about 10 years ago, maybe even closer to 15 years ago, I started looking back on that record and go, man, that's a pretty great record that we made. That was really cool. And we didn't really think much of it when we were doing it. And, you know, I don't want to talk about it like it's Sgt. Pepper's or something, because not only is it not, but we did, you know, it's also not a record that we made tons of money from. There's nothing that special about it to me other than it's a great record. And when you talk to Vandals fans over the last 25 years, a lot of people cite that record as, oh, that was what a great period for the band that was, what a great record that was. And without sitting around patting ourselves on the back, once in a while you do have to stop and go, God, maybe, yeah, I guess that was a really cool record. And for me, two things. That's a record that I go back and listen to sometimes. I don't listen to it top to bottom, but I'll listen to certain songs from it and I go, God, I love that one song. And man, I love these other three or four songs. It's a good comedy. I think there's a bunch of good songs on it. And I say that, you know, I can say that and also tell you that there's Vandals records that I never listen to. Or I might have, there might be a particular album where I go, yeah, there was two good songs on it and there was a bunch of crap. So the reason why I feel okay giving us credit or props on something or saying job well done is because I don't say that about everything. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If I said, yeah, every record we made was better than the last, it's like, no, that's bullshit, you know? And there's, like I said, there's some records that I don't really care for. Live Fast Diarrhea, I think, is a great record. And I think for me, what it is, I think there's a lot of spirit in that record. And what I really remember when I think, I've thought about this before and I thought about it this morning when I knew that we were going to talk about it for a little bit. Something to me that's extra special about that record is we went into it doing it where it's the only album I think I've ever played on where I mean, of course, I'm always going to care about what I'm doing and I want to make it sound decent, but I was almost taking a weird stance, like an experiment, like, you know what? I'm going to play these songs in the studio, and if it's fucked up, it's fucked up, and we're going to move on. And we're not going to fix stuff, and we're not going to triple guess ourselves on things. And if I miss a drum fill, cool. And if I speed up too much in the first chorus, cool. And that's going to be, and we do these tracks. And I'd do a track and miss maybe some of them I might have only played once. And I'd say to Warren, the guitarist, who was also kind of like producing the record, I'd go, this is cool, right? Like, we can move on. I mean, I fucked up, but that's cool. I mean, that's punk, right? I mean, it's like, we're not going to like, we don't want it to sound like a bunch of studio musicians that making it. Like, we want some knees and elbows in there, right? I mean, we can move on. Like, I was kind of like, is it okay?
You want to capture the spontaneity.
I wanted to capture the spontaneity, but sometimes I'm like, it's okay that we move on, right? Because that last drum track kind of like, there was a bunch of fuck ups in it, but let's just keep it, right? I mean, it's cool, right? I mean, and I was almost wanting him, and he was kind of reassuring me, go, yeah, no, it's all good. Fuck it, let's go. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't believe I'm moving on. If this was someone else's record, I'd want to recut that song again or spend some more time on it or play it slightly better. But I kind of took this attitude of like, fuck it, let's just do it, and whatever, however it comes out, that's the way it comes out, we're going to move on. And I did it, and I felt a little bit irresponsible and careless at the time doing it. And listening back to it now, you'd never know. I mean, not that the drum tracks are that great or anything, but yeah, I listened back to it and go, yeah, it sounds great. It's like, at the time, I thought, man, I'm really kind of like, almost fucking up the Vandals by doing this because I'm really like, some of these drum tracks are really shitty. By the time I'm going, but that's what's cool about it, right? Yeah, they're kind of fucked up. Cool, you know, I don't know.
Do you listen to some of your early work, I mean, Vandals or other recordings, and then think about how you would do it differently nowadays?
I don't dwell much on that stuff, but sometimes I'll hear something and go, God, yeah, I would have probably played that a little simpler, or I listen to something and go, God, I wish I would have taken more chances on that. Mm-hmm. But then at the same, then I go 2 seconds later, I go into woulda, coulda, shoulda, who cares? And what's the point of even wondering about that? But yeah, I mean, I will say that instead of listening back to things and wondering, oh, I wonder how I could have done that differently, I will say that I listen back to stuff sometimes. I won't tell you what it was, but I was having this conversation with my brother about a half an hour ago, telling him about a record. It wasn't the Vandals, or somebody else that I played on early on. An early on record I played on, and I go, God, I listened to it the other day for the first time in years. And I go, God, it sucks so bad. So some of the record and some of my drumming, I told my brother, I go, man, I could barely listen to it, but I forced myself to listen to it to go, you know, well, God, what was I thinking? Or maybe it's because I was 18. I don't know. But like there's things I listen to and they're tough to listen to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then there's things, like I said, and I feel like I feel okay admitting that, because then you got to, you know, there's some guys that if you compliment them, they'll go, oh, shucks. Oh, come on. No, that was no good. Oh, really? You think? There's certain things I listen to and I feel good about being able to say, yeah, that was great. Or yeah, I get why people like that. I think that's really good. I'm proud of that. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, if I said that about everything, you'd just blow me off. Go, God, this guy just thinks the shit doesn't stink. But there's plenty of stuff that I think is not that good that I've done and that I played on. So it's like, I feel better. If you could admit that, then you could admit when you do stuff that you like.
Sure. Well, wincing at your early work is also a sign that you recognize the growth and you could appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So Live Fast has both you and Brooks Wackerman listed. What role did Brooks play in?
I didn't know that. Does it really?
Yeah, on the inner sleeve it does.
Oh, that's interesting. It's one of two things. I think I would put money on it that I played all the drums on that record. And I think if anything, around that time, Brooks took over on some touring duties because I wasn't able to go on some of the touring they were doing. And Brooks kind of was right when kind of Brooks became more of a key extra, you know, player in the situation. And who knows, maybe he, I mean, honestly, as goofy as this will sound, he may have like did hand claps on a song or sang backups on something. I think I'm almost positive that I played all the drums on it. But I do know that that's when Brooks was being worked in more like, you know, as someone that was going to play live gigs with them, because I was having to sit some stuff out. I don't know if they were trying to make him feel a part. I wasn't even aware that his name was on it, but yeah, he might have just come down and sang backups on something. But
he did sing backups on Live Fast Diarrhea, but on the inner sleeve, it has him on the same font size and everything as you and Dave and Joe and Warren as well. Although, you know, it does have the instrument next to each of you, but he doesn't have an instrument yet. I think there's a picture of him playing drums.
Oh, I didn't even know that. That's funny.
That's okay. We're going into the record nerd hole here, but yeah. Okay.
Oh, shit. Okay. So yeah, that's weird. I don't know. I don't. Other than all I can think of is they were trying to make him feel like a part of the family, and maybe he did some hand claps and sang a little bit on it or something. And let's let Brooks feel like he's a part of this thing because he's going to go on the road with us for almost a year or something. Because yeah, I don't think he played any drums on that record.
Okay.
I put money on it. He played on some of the Christmas record, and he played on the Look What I Almost Stepped In record. But yeah, I don't think he played on Live Fast Diarrhea.
But now, there's a number of drummers like yourself that seem to be working all the time. Kenny Aronoff, Vinnie Caliuta, Brooks Wackerman. Is there a competition between the session drummers?
Oh, you know what? If there is, I'm not aware of it. I mean, I think that for me,
I would assume it would be friendly. It would be, oh, you got that gig, or hey, guess what? I got this song, that kind of thing, jocular. But yeah, not evil competitive. But
yeah, most of the guys that I know, and even the, all the guys that you just mentioned, I'm on good terms with and have known for years and years. Vinny and Kenny and Abra Boyle Jr. and Jim Keltner and John Robinson, all these dudes that have been busy in the studio for years. And yeah, I'm friends with all of them. And I can honestly say, even if there was something that I played on that someone, you know, if I'd hear through the grapevine, oh, did you hear that so-and-so actually didn't use your track you did with them and they ended up hiring Vinny to play on it? Never once, actually, I honestly say, have I felt like, oh man, that motherfucker, I can't believe that. Like, I was always like, okay, that's, you know, whatever, that's fine. I had one of my favorite guitar players years ago play guitar on something for me. And he came to the studio and he played a solo on something and it didn't sound right for the song. I tried to get something out of him and it didn't really work out. And I'll never forget going, okay, you know what, Josh, you can't take it personal if you do a drum track for someone and if someone ends up not liking it. Of course, you always do kind of take it personally for a minute, or you want to know that they loved it and everything. Everyone thought it was great. But there's times when, you know, I've been replacing the studio, and there's times that I've replaced some legendary drummers in the studio. There's been times where I'm going, why am I doing this? Why are you having me playing this track if you had so-and-so playing this track? And they're like, you know what? I don't know what it was. It just didn't feel right. It just wasn't the vibe. I'm like, okay, well, here I am. I'll do my best. And the time I had my guitar player buddy, who's a genius on the guitar, playing something, and I ended up redoing it with another guitar player because it just didn't sit right. It just didn't feel right. And it wasn't what I was hoping for. And it doesn't mean this guy's not great. And doesn't mean this guy's not still one of my favorite guitarists, but it just, I go back to that all the time and go, not all the time is everyone, you know, good for everything or right for said song that you're working on. So yeah, like I said, I think sometimes also the competition thing, sometimes it's guys that it might be on a rung or two down from some of the top guys where they get a little more competitive because they've got a little something more to prove, or they're trying to make a name for themselves. Maybe they almost have, but they haven't. So it's, they might get a little bit more, aggressive or upset about hearing someone else getting the job for something. But a lot of the top guys, I see a lot of those guys, they're doing really well. Everyone's kind of feeling comfortable enough in their own skin to not take it personal or not get worked up about it if someone else got the gig on something. You know what I mean?
There's enough for everyone to eat at that level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
We had Brain on the show.
And oh, yeah, he's an old friend.
Yeah, he was talking about having to redo your drumming on Chinese Democracy, literally note for note, like play exactly
so what
that was very peculiar. What do you make of that?
I'll tell you exactly what I make of it. I think that Axel, I'm not speaking for him, but this is what I think happened from my time spent around that camp, and not just that camp, my time spent around other people that are making records and important kind of legendary artists that are making albums, then they know that there's a lot of eyes and ears on them at that time, like Axel did. Sometimes people, when they can be in fear of completing something or in fear of admitting, okay, this is now done and now we're going to release this, they'll give themselves busy work. They'll give themselves things to do to make them feel like they're moving forward and things are being done in the studio. I think at that time, my guess, and from what I can gather, is that I'm sure that that was unnecessary to have Brain redo all those drums and do them note for note. You know, did it make everyone down there think that they were pushing forward and doing the right thing? I guess at the time it did, and it probably put off having to complete it quite yet. You know what I mean? And, you know, there's times, you know, I'm not going to say who the artist was, and it may or may not have been Guns N' Roses, but I remember working on a record that was taking a long time, and me saying, "Where's the singer?" And they said, "Oh, he's up in his home studio right now, like A being monitors with this company, because he can put new monitors in his home studio." And I'm thinking, "Why isn't he down here doing stuff with us? You know, like we're working on a record in an actual recording studio. Why the hell is he messing around with different monitors he might have at his home studio?" Like, once again, it came down to this particular guy didn't want to, you know, he just wanted more busy work and more stuff to do, where he felt like things were being done, and you know, the real task at hand was kind of being put on the back burner, you know. So I think he was procrastinating. I think he's procrastinating having Brain do that. And also, I will say this, and to Axel's credit, I think he liked what I did on the record, but I think he really wanted Brain. I didn't take it at all. Like some people said, oh man, did you take that as like a FU, you know, or a slag from Axel? Not at all. I saw it as Axel wanting Brain, who was now going to be the new drummer, to really feel like a part of things and really and share having a stake in this record he was going to go out on tour on. He's like, well, we know Josh isn't around. Let's have Brain do the drums. We'll have him on the record. He's going to be out on the road with us. And that only made sense to me. They wanted him to feel welcome and part of the family. Sure. And but did he have to play it note for note? That's a little bit silly, but at the same time, I don't know. I actually liked what I did. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a bit, it's silly and I get it. How about that? Like, right. It makes sense and it doesn't make sense. I don't know.
Well, it belongs in the story of Chinese democracy anyway. If that yes. story is going to go anywhere.
Well, one of my favorite wacky little feathers in my cap is the fact that I wrote the song Chinese Democracy. So when if I ever walk into a room full of people and they go, oh my God, then I heard this happen, then I heard that happen. I'll walk into a room full of people. Sometimes I know the people, sometimes I don't know the people. I go, what are you guys all talking about? They go, we're talking about Chinese democracy. And I raise my hand. I go, I wrote Chinese democracy. I wrote the music and actually wrote the lyrics. And, you know, for a while there, what I really liked is you used to be able to look at Wikipedia and it'd say Chinese democracy song. And it'd say authors W. Axl Rose and J. Fries. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, he's like divvied out like, you know, publishing money. There's like somehow now there's like, it's like a hip hop track. There's like 10 writers on it. Yep. You know, you go, wait a second, written by T. Stinson and R. Fink and so-and-so and Dizzy Reed. I'm going, wait a second, what the hell? And all I can gather from that is that once again, wanting people to feel like they were a part of it, it might've been someone coming in one day and go, you know what, Axel, I think this song needs to be 5 BPMs faster than it is. And he might go, you know what? You're right. I'm giving you 3% of the publishing. I mean, you know, you really saved the song. You know, I don't know. All I know is I wrote the music, right. Actually wrote the lyrics and the melody, and somehow there's 7 writers on it. But it should be 50-50. What am I going to do? Like go, you know, Davy and Goliath. Am I going to go try and sue Axl Rose for more a portion of the song and like spend all the money that I would have maybe gotten if I might win. It's like, it wasn't worth it. You know, and to be honest, I was happy just being involved and having the experience that I did. It didn't bother me, you know?
Yeah. The birth of that album was very difficult. Any other projects you've been involved in where it was, well, maybe not the Chinese democracy level, but for example, A Perfect Circle, how easy, how organic was the birth of that first album?
Well, the first one was really organic, but I mean, that being said, a lot of the stuff was, the majority of the stuff was stuff that Billy Howardell had, you know, essentially had his whole life to write. He was sitting on these songs he'd been working on and fine-tuning for many years. And what I do like about that first record a lot, and speaking of it coming together organically, is there was a lot of it that we would go into. Like, we didn't think we were making a record at the time. Like, my drum tracks that I was doing, most of the drum tracks on there were like, we had enough friends that had studios and decent studios where we go in and we do a couple of quote-unquote demos. And at the end of the demo session, Billy Howardell might say to me, hey, Josh, I've got this one last idea, and we're going to recut it like in a week or two. So let me just play it down once or twice. I know we have to be out of here in 15 minutes. So just play to it a couple times and see what happens, because I'd rather write to that than have to write to the crummy drum machine loop that's on there right now. So I say, great. So I'd whip this thing out really quick, and maybe there would be a couple weird fills in the first verse that I wouldn't have normally played, but I didn't realize the verse was starting yet or whatever, because I didn't really know the song. But I'd play along to it, and then in the end, I would hear like, oh yeah, we're just having Alan Mulder mix that song. Like, we're not going to retrack that. It sounds great. And I'm like, really? Okay. Well, I didn't really, I may have maybe paid a little more attention knowing this was going to be the one on the album. But in the end, I listened to it and go, God, once again, on a different level, but similar to the Live Fast Diarrhea stuff, I'm going, there's a great spirit to it and spontaneity to it. And yeah, I don't have to play it more. I think it sounds great. You know what, that weird fill in the first verse? I would have never played that normally, but now I've kind of gotten used to it. And it's kind of cool that it happens right there after the very first line of the first verse. There's a drum fill for no reason at all. Okay, cool. So we kind of made that record without having the pressure of, okay, it's Monday morning. You guys are going in to retrack the record. Everything you do is going to be listened to for years to come. It's like, we kind of made it without knowing we were actually officially making it. And so we were kind of had fun making it, meaning working on these songs, knowing that we can have fun with them because we can just retrack them anyways in a few months when our record deal comes through. And when the record deal came through, we just said, fuck it, let's just like retrack these two songs and we're going to have Alan mix the rest of the stuff and make it sound fantastic, which is what happened. So yeah, that record came together real organically in that respect of just going, you know, like I said, not having the pressure of now we're going to start the record today. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of just kind of materialized before our very eyes. We kind of went, oh shit, I guess we made a record without even really trying.
So was the pressure on for the 13th step? Was that different?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was different. It was different. That being said, Billy now had a great home studio, and the good and the bad part is that, I mean, we didn't stretch it into Chinese Democracy length of recording, but we spent a lot of time working on it. And, you know, sometimes it is good to have deadlines and have limited time to finish something. Mm-hmm. Because, you have to finish it up. You can't second guess stuff. And there's some second guessing happening on 13th Step, but not as much as other projects I've been involved in. And also the fact that, you know, Billy had his whole life to write that first record, but then we had, you know, 8 months to write and record the second record, you know, mm-hmm. if we wanted to stay on schedule with everything. So with that record, I'm proud of that record as well. I think that 13th Step record is great. You know, ask most Perfect Circle fans, they'll tell you how much better the first one is. And I think that first record is really special, but I like them both, you know, and I even grown to like the, at the time we made an album to just kind of get out of our deal with Virgin. We had to make a third record for him, so we made this album of covers, which I just thought was the biggest cop-out. I was like, oh, God, you're kidding me. Like, it'd be one thing if we made seven records and then we made a covers album, but like, really, our third album's gonna be covers? But I really liked it. I listen back to it now, and I think it sounds great. I think it's really cool because a lot of those songs, we deconstructed them enough to where, you know, it's always lame when someone does a cover of a song and they basically just try and re-record the song. Like, I'm going to somehow make Stairway to Heaven better than the original. I'm going to play it exactly the way Led Zeppelin. It's like, what's the point in doing that, you know? And then you listen to something like Satisfaction by Devo and go, wow, this is so cool. You never, ever know this is supposed to be the Rolling Stones song unless you listen to the lyrics, you know?
Yeah.
And we used that, everyone in the band being Devo fans, we used that as kind of a measuring stick on how to do a cover song. So we listen to some of that stuff and listen to the fucking the Fear cover or the Zeppelin cover. It's like they sound nothing like, you know, I mean, nothing like the originals, which is that they're entirely different songs, except for the lyrical content, really. Different notes, different rhythms, different grooves. And that's, I think it's great. So yeah, I look back in hindsight, you know, I'm proud of that record.
Now, around that time, you were also involved in the Tapeworm Project. And from what I understand, there was a collection of songs for Tapeworm, and at one point it was reportedly ready to mix. So it wasn't just a couple of songs. It sounds like there were probably eight or more songs that were tracked and in decent shape. Is that your recollection?
I don't remember how many songs were ready to mix or not. I do know that I went down with Trent and Atticus and Danny Lohner. Maybe Maynard was there when we were doing these drums, maybe not. We went to Atlanta to a studio that Brendan O'Brien, people used to think it was Brendan O'Brien's studio because he had it booked out for years, but he didn't actually own it. But Brendan used to make all of his albums or most of his stuff down there at this place. It was called Southern Tracks. Great studio in Atlanta. And I think Trent wanted a break from New Orleans. So he's like, yeah, we're going to get out of New Orleans. We're going to come up to Atlanta and track drums there. I want to get out of my room, basically. And so that made sense. And we went there and it was awesome. And I did a bunch of drums, and I knew Trent a little bit from the year before when Perfect Circle opened up for Nine Inch Nails. But I really feel like that recording, that week we spent in Atlanta, was where we kind of got to know each other on a different level than just running into each other at catering backstage at these arenas, and really work together, you know. And I got to see how great he is, because before that I'd just seen the guy on stage with strobe lights and smoke, and he makes these records supposedly, but who knows, you know. And this is where I really got to see him and how he takes control of you know, whatever he's working on in the studio. He's not a guy, I've watched singers show up and go, okay, where do I sing? Point me in the direction of the vocal booth. And they go in there and they sing, and then they leave. Trent's there from the beginning of the day to the end of the day, and he's working on getting the hum out of that bass cabinet. And wow, the drum, the room mic sound out of phase, so he's going to flip the thing. Like, he is hands-on and knows exactly what the hell he's doing. And that's when I really took note of that. I went, oh, shit, this guy really does know what he's doing. So that was fun for me. And doing these drums, the tracks were great, as I recall. And then we finished the drums. I went back to California. They went back down to New Orleans. And then it was like, it just kind of like, you know, stopped. And I don't know all the details of it, other than I think I laugh about it with Danny Lohner, who I see fairly often. I was like, man, the more people ask, and then, you know, a couple of years later, I started working with Trent playing at Nine Inch Nails, and the tapeworm thing comes up all the time. And my theory is like, man, he's so sick of being asked about it. The more he gets asked about it, the more he's never going to put it out. He just like fucking hates it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, man, I'm fucking tired of hearing everyone ask me about tape fucking worm all the time. So it's like, God damn it. But, you know, I forget. I want to say I saw an interview with him where he said, you know, you put together, you know, what you think should be a Nine Inch Nails Tool collaboration. It should be a 10 out of 10. And to him, it was sounding like a 7 out of 10, you know. Mm. And I don't think he felt it was fully realized, or what he thought was realized in the end wasn't really, like I said, kind of up to par. And so I think he felt a little bit let down about that, and got involved in just Nine Inch Nails world again. And it kind of just kind of like fell to the wayside, you know. Yeah. But I did enjoy being a part of it, and I really liked being Atlanta Trek on those drums. And I was like, at that point, seeing that I'm kind of quote unquote just the drummer on that shit, I kind of came, did my job, and left. And then I was like, I don't know what's going on with those guys. I don't know if Maynard and Trent were butting heads. I don't know if Trent just wasn't loving the way the songs were coming out, but whatever it is, that's between them. And I'm not going to be another person to ask them about why it's not happening, because right. I think they're sick of talking about it. You know?
Yeah. At some point in that early A Perfect Circle tour, there were some Tapeworm songs that were being played. I believe Vacant and a few others. So they actually made it way into the set list, yeah?
Yeah, I think there was, yeah. And I can't remember if Trent thought that was cool or not.
He didn't. Let me remind you, he didn't.
Why did he? Was there an interview with him where he was, what do you know? Because I'm sure I've heard it and just forgot about it, or people would tell me about it, but what do you recall?
Well, I can't remember the exact quote, but I seem to remember the tone of it was, I really wish those guys didn't do that. And I got the feeling that it kind of put things on ice for a little while. I'm sure they're fine right. now, but yeah, like you say, he didn't want it out before it was fully realized. And I think that, you know, that was also right. the cusp of when people started recording. Everyone had a recorder in their pocket, you know?
Right.
So I'm sure it wasn't meant to be leaked out, but it did.
Sure. Yeah, I gotcha. And it was like a live version, like a shitty, it wasn't like us record. It
no,
wasn't a recorded
no,
version.
I think you guys did a residency in San Jose for, I think, several weeks, kind of warming up A Perfect Circle initially. Uh-huh. And I think it was from one of those shows.
Oh, okay. Oh, shit. Okay.
That's okay.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Oh, well. So we got a little peek of it. Well, let me ask you this. How do you listen to music today? Do you have a record player? Do you have a vinyl collection?
I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't. And I, you know, sometimes I beat myself up a little bit for it and go, man, why don't I have a cool record? And I'm like, you know what? I've got so many friends that have such killer collections. Like, what am I starting now? Or what? Go buy fucking, what? 2 dozen albums, yeah. You know? Like, But okay, let me go back a minute. We got a really crummy, it looked really cool. It was like powder blue or something, or this weird lavender, like portable turntable from like Target. And it kind of looked retro. And my kid's like, that looks so cool. My wife's like, let's get it. And I should have known it was $100, you know? And it sucked. And we brought it home and it was cool. We put an album on. It's like, it's cool. But it's like, the record started getting skippy. Like they started skipping and being weird. I'm like, oh, it's because the needle's so shitty. And this thing is basically a toy, right? But for the few weeks that we were playing records on, I go, God, this is cool. We put an album on and we can't just hit next. We can't just take a button or say, Alexa, next song. Like we're kind of committing to the record and the experience. And it was this cool little the corner of our living room that we had. And to be honest, you're reminding me just now, just bringing it up, that for a while I was telling my wife, you know what we should do? We should actually get a real turntable and a nice system. We don't have to get crazy and like forensic about it. Some people get super, super heavy. Let's buy something decent. Let's have albums that we can listen to in our house. Yeah, like my son had a little one of those portable turntables from Target, and he had it in his room. My 12-year-old, and he was listening. He actually had some Vandals vinyl. He was listening to Vandals records. So I'm like, oh, so cool, and he was enjoying it. And but yeah, it was the machines were so crummy that they started skipping and just being weird, and you know, and I'm like, man, we got to get some real. We can't just have this like plastic toy that looks neat. But that being said, I don't think I'll ever have a killer collection, but I do go, you know, we should have some records just to, because it's kind of fun just doing that.
A turntable is like a getting a pet, you know? It brings the family together, at least for a period of time until you get sick of them, right? But
it's, yeah, but, you yeah know, exactly.
It is something to kind of get everyone on the same page. And it has this ritual that allows people to focus a little bit more than, like you say, you know, something streaming.
Yeah, I agree. That's why we felt that a little bit when we had the silly Target turntables, but I was like, I got to get a real turntable. And then I forgot about it. And now I'm remembering. So thank you.
Well, I'm sure over at, I'm sure the guys at Nitro Records will send you a copy of this Vandals Live Fast Diarrhea, the diarrhea splatter pressing. Have you seen this one?
Nice. No, well, I sort of, I saw it online or something. I saw a picture of it.
Yeah. Just like you would imagine it. So
my kids might be into it. Yeah.
Well, what's the story of the cover of that album? There was that photo is a replacement. Oh, yeah,
it's a great story. I love the story because I don't know a whole lot about art or cool artists, but and I don't pretend to, but this guy is a guy that we all gravitated towards because I think Joe Escalante had like one of his, there's now multiple like coffee table books and books you can get on him and stuff, but this is over 25 years ago. So is this artist named Chris Burden, who just died, I think, about 3-4 years ago, skin cancer. But in recent years, he's become famous for, like, he was a big guy at LACMA. And do you live in Los Angeles? Where do you live?
I'm in Sydney. I'm in Sydney, Australia.
Oh, you are? Shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
LACMA, by the way?
LACMA is, God, I'm going to, what is it?
Los Angeles County Museum of Art.
There you go. Yeah. And, he's outside of it on Wilshire Boulevard. There's like 400 like old school street lamps and these street lights. And he did that. That's one of his quote unquote pieces. And he has this thing that's been in there for years called Metropolis 2, which is like the world's biggest indoor like model car set in this whole city. Mm-hmm. You can go in there and like 3 or 4 times a day, they run it for a half an hour and it's really cool. It was Chris Burden was this crazy performance artist guy from the 70s from LA. They would do shit like, you know, shoot himself, you know, or have someone shoot him from 5 feet away with a gun. They'd film it, and then that'd be an installation. Then they'd sell the gun or take a photo of his arm bleeding. Like, just all this wacky, wacky performance art stuff. And one of them is a picture of him out in a field with a suit on, with a handgun, and he's shooting at a 747 flying over him. And I can't remember if he was actually shooting it or not. I think he may have been actually shooting bullets. I don't think he was looking to take down a plane. Mm-hmm. So that part would be hard to believe because he seemed like a decent guy. So I don't think he was trying to murder 300 people. But he was shooting in a plane or looking like he was shooting a plane. And we wanted to use that photo. This guy looked like I said, looked like an FBI agent sitting in this field with a gun up with a plane overhead. And if you look at some of the inside credit collage photos, there's like a... there's like a memo from, looks like it come from like the desk of a secretary or an assistant saying, call Chris Burden's or Chris Burden's office called back and said, you can't use the photo or, you know, no good on the photo or something like that. So right. What that's supposed to be, that's supposed to be like the blueprint of what the album is going to look like.
Eventually. The mock-up almost. Right.
It's the mock-up of this is what it's going to be when we get the okay to use the Chris Burden photo. You can go see the photo if you put Chris Burden.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Chris Burden, 747, 1973. Yeah.
There you go. A photo of him in 1973, probably near LAX. And we liked the photo. We wanted to use it. And they said no. And we were fine with that. We said, okay, well, fuck it. We're going to do our own little, you know, homage to Chris Burden. We're not even mad at him. It's fine. He didn't want some stupid punk band using his photo for this. For their album cover. So it's fine. And it ended up being cooler in a way. There's more of a story behind it. And it's more interesting than just that photo, I think.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I always saw it. And it, to me, it screams punk because it looks like a punk flyer. So.
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a good DIY aspect to it, you know?
Now, one final question. One recording that fascinates me is the Dweezil Zappa Confessions. Yeah. Okay.
What about it?
Why the laughter? The first off.
Well, this is the first album I ever made, you know? And it's like I was like 15 or 16. And
yeah.
Some of it's hard to listen to. Some of it's fun to listen to. Yeah. It's, yeah. That's definitely.
Is that the one you were talking about earlier where you were playing it wincing? No,
I don't think it was that.
Okay.
Might have been that.
So you were 15 when you recorded Confessions?
I think so. 15 okay. or 16.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're playing alongside Mike Keneally, Scott Thunis. In that, obviously, you're working with Dweezil. Was Frank around at the time?
Frank was around. He wasn't hanging out in the studio with us, but he was alive, and we'd see him, and we'd go back to the house and play him recordings that we were working on, and I definitely hung out with Frank quite a bit, as much as any 16-year-old kid could be hanging out with Frank Zappa. I was hanging out with Frank Zappa in the room because I was friends with his kids and played in his son's band. So Frank and I weren't hanging out one-on-one ever. There was one, I will tell you, because I was a huge Frank Zappa fan, I will tell you the one time, there's a very special night that I was, his studio was on the ground floor of their house, and it was very close to this front gate that came off their driveway. And off the driveway, there was a gate, and you could buzz in, and you could either go to the left and go up these stairs to the kitchen, or you could continue on straight, and you end up in his recording studio. So my car was parked across the street. It was late at night, and I was going out to grab something out of my car. I forget if I forgot what the hell it was, but I got in my car to grab something, and it's quiet, and it's up in the hills, up in Laurel Canyon, right in the Hollywood Hills, and I'm coming through the gate, and it almost startled me, but Frank was like at the gate because he'd heard or something, and he goes, hey. I go, hey. And he goes, hey, you want to come in here and listen to this percussion piece I just did? I just finished this percussion piece all on this clavier. You should check it out. And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. There's no one around. There's no other kids. And Frank's like, hey, Josh, you should come listen to this thing. I was like, fuck, this is crazy. What a moment. And I went in there and I sat in the studio and I listened to it and went, oh my God, this is so cool. It's so great. I can't remember if it turned into anything or it was ever released. I can't even tell you what the piece, I do remember there's a lot of kind of orchestral drums being played, but it was all samples. But it was amazing how clear and high quality the samples were, where you go, God, it sounds like a drummer in a giant room playing a buzz roll and a snare drum, but it's a fucking computer playing it. Like, that's not an actual drummer playing a buzz roll. Or was it a sample of a drummer? However he laid it in, and big, giant, cavernous sounding kick bass drums being played and big, clangy cymbal hits. And it was really cool. But like I said, I couldn't remember. It's almost like time and, you know, all time kind of got sucked out of the room. And because it was just more of like, I can't believe that I'm just sitting with Frank Zappa at 1 a.m. in a studio that I used to read about. And I'm sitting here and I'm 16 and he's wanting to play me this thing. It was such a special moment for me.
Was he looking for an opinion? Was he looking just for a reaction or he needed some company?
Yeah. Both. It was kind of like, it was like this, I got the feeling he was like, he just finished it. Who can he play for? Oh, there's Dweezil's drummer that's coming back in the gate. Hey, kid, come here. Check this out. Let me play this for you. It was a reaction. He wanted to share it with somebody, you know? And it was really, really special for me. So Frank was around. But like I said, he wasn't producing the stuff we were working on. And I never jammed with him. You know, I never played with him. But I was around him a lot up at that house. And that was pretty special. You
That's
know?
Nice. You had a moment with him. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, Josh, I know you got to get going. I do want to remind folks, nitrorecords.com, The Vandals, 25 years, Live Fast, Diarrhea, the splatter version. You got to go there just to even just see this record. It's pretty amazing what they could do with technology these days. It's fully remastered. There's shirts up there. And again, celebrate 25 years of The Vandals, Live Fast, Diarrhea at nitrorecords.com. And again, Josh, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide and sharing all those stories, and much appreciated, mate.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All righty, there we have it, Mr. Josh Freeze. Thank you so much for darkening our doorstep, Mr. Freeze. I know you're a busy man. COVID or not, you got a lot going on, a lot of bands to cover, a lot of sessions to play, and we wish you all the best. Again, everyone can go to nitrorecords.com, check out The Vandals 25-year anniversary, Live Fast, Diarrhea, available now on that poopy splatter pressing. You got to just see the picture of it. Go to nitrorecords.com, if for nothing else, just for your curiosity. And I'm sure, one way or another, you're going to be pretty impressed just looking at the visuals of this record. That's nitrorecords.com, or you could also follow Josh Freeze on Twitter at Josh Freeze. That is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again to everyone who's tuning in. Look, I know times are tough out there, and not everyone can be part of our Patreon community and be getting records left and right that we talk about here on the show. But what you can do, if you enjoy this show, please tell your friends about it. Please share it on social media. And ultimately, if you have a minute or two, please go give us a positive review. You can go to Apple iTunes or Stitcher, whatever. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10. Rate us high. Say something nice. That is always appreciated. And I am eternally grateful to all the listeners who take the time to do that. Anyway, we will be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.